All right, so this thing's like distracting. Okay, so it's the 17th of Tammuz, even though it's the 18th, but we start commemorating today. So today's a fast day. It's not a there. I have this open. This is the Mishnah Berurah, which is it's the actual Shulchan Aruch, which was written codified law from Yosef Cairo in the late 1400s, which is that big. If you see that set there with the big red books. That's the Shulchan Aruch, right? The big one.
And everything's in Hebrew.
Oh, yeah.
And you read and understand.
I don't know about understand, but yeah, I can read it now. Yeah, so no. So the idea is yes.
Okay.
So now Rav Yosef Cairo is really a culmination of generations of development of law, and it's still continuously being developed. And it's the codification, which some people say was a good thing, some people say it's a necessary thing, some people say it was a bad thing because it created more. Took away certain flexibility, but the truth is that that's a place where we can go and access, you know, basically it's like case law, right? Or a little bit more than case law, but it's like the idea that you have a place to go, a source for a lot of the different laws that we want to know. What do you do in this situation, that situation? It covers everything.
You said it's still being developed?
Yeah,
because... Does that mean that if next year you buy a set of Shulchan Aruch books
off of that...
Well, that's why I asked.
Right, so this is a perfect example. So what I have here is the Mishnah Berurah. So the Mishnah Berurah was written by the Chafetz Chaim. He lived in the early 1900s. He passed away in 1933. So he also wrote, and he put a lot of effort into talking about guarding your tongue. I don't know if you ever saw that book, Guard Your Tongue, or being careful about how we speak. Shmirat Halashon, Chavetz Chaim. He was called the Chavetz Chaim, the one who desires life, because the saying is there's a line in Psalms that says, the one who seeks life should do what? Should guard your tongue, be careful not to speak ill of other people, etc. So he spent a lot of time emphasizing that mitzvah of be careful what you how you not to be, you know, someone who speaks Lashon Hara, right? That is the Chafetz Chaim really popularized that, even though there are others that even again before him spoke about it, but he spent a lot of time and put a lot of effort into that. Okay, so the idea of this development, Larry, is that the Mishnah Berurah, so here he takes, there are four sections of law. And one of them is called Orach Chaim, which is the path of life. Yerideya talks about like the laws of kosher. That's another one. Evin Ezer talks about the laws of marriage. So this Orach Chaim talks about, let's say, daily life, daily practice, prayer, blessings, and then Shabbos, other holidays. I'm looking over there. Okay, so here, this is one of the sections, one of the books. There are six books that came out of the Mishnah, out of Orach Chaim, and what the Chafetz Chaim added on. So here he's in. Here the Chafetz Chaim lives in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he writes an entire add-on to the Shulchan Aruch, okay? In specifically this one pillar of the Shulchan Aruch. He didn't take all four, just one, Orach Chaim, and he started writing, explaining, okay? This volume that I have here is actually just came out in the last couple of years. In this, it has additional stuff of people who lived in the last 50 years, what they added on, okay? So it's... Do you understand what I mean by...
Yes. Okay,
so this idea of... Yeah, there's an evolution or
so
new
really
things come
like
up.
So it really is like case law. So
yeah, it constantly comes up. And so I'm sitting here. I got in front of me... it talks about the laws of the 3 weeks, Tisha B'Av. Now, the truth is, let's say for my friend over there who's from the Sephardic background, right? Not to like... But we actually... There's a breakdown between Sephard and Ashkenaz in terms of how we practice. So the Shulchan Aruch was written by Rav Yosef Cairo, who was of Sephardic descent. He's looking at the Rambam. Maimonides of Sephardic descent. So the Rambam lived in the 1200s, comes along the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Cairo. He's analyzing and actually writes a commentary on the Rambam's work. He then also pulls from other sources within the Talmudic discussions and development, and then he writes his Shulchan Aruch, okay? And then, but you have already in the Shulchan Aruch, you have the Ramah, or Moshe Israelis, who's writing from the Ashkenaz perspective. So you start having a break, like a difference of practice between Ashkenaz and Sfard, okay? To the point where, here's a perfect example. When it comes to the 3 weeks.
That's a quick question. Yes. Is that a breakdown because...
Oh, wait, David, also, you're coming from Turkish back... Is that also a Sephardic background? You'll like this because you'll see where it goes for this specific thing. But okay, yeah, you're asking a question.
Is the breakdown because the two lived separately and didn't communicate, so the natural evolution took off really generously, or they actually clashed and disagreed in real time?
They definitely, the answer is both, I would say. I mean, it's interesting to analyze exactly why you have this development that they actually diverge and have this difference of practice. If it really goes back to, it could be multiple things. It could be also cultural in terms of where they lived and how things just developed. But you see in the way that the Talmudic discussions then go off to the first group of people that are analyzing the Talmud are called the Rishonim, the first ones. There is a difference already between Maimonides, who's living in Spain and Egypt and there, and the Rosh and Rashi, Tosfos, who are living more in the European lands. Why that is, how it develops, there are different schools, and the different schools diverge. There's obviously they have more in common than they differ. But it's interesting. It would be interesting. There must be scholarly work that's written on describing and understanding how you get this different development. But you do. So here's a perfect case point. So when it comes to this period of time. So you have the 3 weeks. It starts with the 17th of Tammuz. It ends with the 9th of Av. Okay. Here we're going to look at the Gemara that explains the five different things that happened on Shavuot Sabbatamas, the 17th of Tammuz, and the five things that happened on Tisha B'Av. Fine. But let's talk about practical halacha, right, for a second, and how this example of divergence between Sfard and Ashkenaz. So when it comes to Sfard, they would hold that it starts with, when do we start mourning? When do you think we start mourning?
For this?
Yeah.
That morning.
Which is when? The 17th? The 17th of Tammuz?
No, the 18th.
Whatever. But you say, right? Okay, again, but it starts on the 17th of Tammuz is what you would say. That's what, the way, it's not a trick question.
No, but when was it? Because you're fasting to mourn the destruction of the temple, correct?
Well, we're today we're fasting. Let's look at
the structure of the temple is a three.
Let's look inside for a second. Let's look at the Gemara, and then we're going to take a step away from. Then I want you to see. It's very interesting to see how the halachas develop. But let's just look at the Talmud. The Talmud and Tana says, and again, I'm taking out from the Talmud anything that's bold is the actual Talmudic words translated, and then if it's not bolded, it's kind of like this. Whoever wrote this interpretation, which I'm getting off of Sefaria, which is really coming from probably like the translation from what's his name from Steinsaltz. So that's like his added commentary. Okay, fine. Five calamitous matters occurred to our forefathers on the 17th of Tammuz, and five other disasters happened on the 9th of Av. Okay, on the 17th of Tammuz, what happened? Five things. The tablets were broken by Moses when he saw the Jews had made the golden calf, which is what I want to focus on today, because it's always the first thing that defines the other things that are going to come after. So the defining thing of 17th of Tammuz is, here we have, the Jews come out of Egypt, 50 days later, they come to Sinai, we have this mega event, the event of all events. It makes concerts look like a nothing, like there's no the sound and lights, nothing. This is like the most incredible event of all time. Defines us as a people. It makes us, as we learned yesterday in the Maral, it defined us as a people. It elevated us to this incredibly high spiritual plane. And then not 40 days later do the Jewish people create an idol and worship it. Moses comes down, sees it, and he breaks the tablets. 17th of Tammuz. This is the beginning of bad things that happen on this day. Okay, what are the four of the things that the Talmud records as things that have happened on this day? Number two, the daily offering was nullified by the Roman authorities and it was never sacrificed again, which, by the way, what that means is that from the time of Sinai, every single day, thousands of years, every day a daily sacrifice was brought. And that's why it's such a tragic event that when it was stopped by the Romans, thousands of years later, it was a horrible thing. A tamid means it literally came every single day for thousands of years.
So the Romans prevented us from doing it.
Correct. On the 17th of Tammuz. The third thing, the city walls of Jerusalem were breached. This is talking about the Second Temple period. Even though there was a breach of the walls around this time, but it wasn't on the 17th, it was on the 9th, in the First Temple. Although some will say that it also happened on the 17th of Tammuz, on the First Temple destruction. But we'll say this is talking specifically about the Second Temple destruction. Number four, the general apostates publicly burned a Torah scroll. Now, what's unique about this Torah scroll was that it dated back to Moses' one of the original scrolls that Moses had commissioned. If you look at our Torahs today, they're consistent. They're all, it's not like, this one has a couple of differences here.
Not like the King James Bible.
It's incredible how consistent, there's like no difference between all of our scrolls are the same, which is wild. But here, one of the originals was burned by Apostemus. And he was one of the Greek generals, and he lived at the time of the Second Temple. And then number five was Menashe placed an idol in the sanctuary. Not a good thing, right, for a Jewish leader to put a idol in the place that's supposed to be, you know, dedicated to God and to the idea of monotheism, to put an idol, not a good thing. All these five things happened on the 17th of Tammuz. So now, let's just look at the 9th of Av for a second. What happened on the 9th of Av? It was decreed upon our ancestors that they would all die in the wilderness and not enter Eretz Yisrael, right, the spies. Mm-hmm. And so when they came back, I gave a quick little idea at the dinner where we said that here the spies come back, they give this negative report, and then the punishment was 40 years in the desert. So usually God does, the punishment is usually commensurate with the crime. So if they came back and they gave a negative report, so why were they given 40 years? So the answer is that they were actually punished not just for the negative report, but for the 40 days that they walked around the land of Israel because they were looking for the bad. Right, so that's okay, but what comes out is that the decree, because when they started crying on that day, it was the 9th of Av, they cried that night, they accepted the negative report, which is also, you know, part of the whole, when it comes to the laws of Lashon Hara, you have three people involved. You have the person telling, you have the person receiving, and the person that's being told about, right? But the person who's receiving is just as equally, right? Because here, you can do this, but even if you're hearing it, you still have that option of saying, do I believe it or do I accept this or not? The fact that they accepted it, and not only did they accept it, they started crying that night. So then we say, okay, God says, the deal's off, guys. You're not going into the land. This generation is not going to the land. So anybody that was above, from 20 and above, they died out in the desert. So that was that decree on the 9th of Av. And then from there, 2 and 3, temple was destroyed the first time in the days of Nebuchadnezzar and the second time by the Romans. Number 4, Beitar was captured, which was this huge metropolis Jewish city and was also destroyed. So there were millions of people that were killed. And then number 5, and the city of Jerusalem was plowed as a sign that it would never be rebuilt. So now, in the Talmud, what it says is that, let's say, okay, I'll read on here. Not only does the one fast on the 9th of Av, but from when the month of Av begins, one decreases acts of rejoicing.
That's today.
No, the 9th of Av. Today's the 17th of Tammuz, right? No. So right. So if you look at the calendar, you'll see that we're starting a 21-day period. There are only 9 days from the 9th of Av. It starts from the first day of Av, 9 days. So there's another additional, right? That's the 17th. We're starting at Tammuz here, and it goes into Av. But what the Talmud says is that when does the sadness begin according to the Talmud, it starts at the ninth of Av.
The Sephardi
Rosh Chodesh.
Ah. Ah, so it's so wait, so wait, so wait. Hey, you can point to him also. Although you probably like, I don't know, you probably have more Asher. Okay, but no, so we see that the Talmud, we call it Me'ikar Adin, from the like the letter of the law, is that we see that the Talmud says that the sadness or the decrease of joy starts not now,
right, the first of Av.
Right. So then you start asking yourself, so you know, what's the story here? So. How even according to the Sfarad, there's this 3-week period, but in terms of taking on practices of mourning in that, according to that school of thought, it would say no. The Talmud says it starts from the first day of Av. That's when it starts. There's something about that, and then not only that. In Sfarad, it's called Shvu Shachalba. It's the week that we commemorate the day. So, for example, this year it's even better because there is no week, because Tisha B'Av comes out on Shabbos. So there normally, let's say Tisha B'Av came out on Wednesday, so then it would work as Shabbos, and then that week is called the week that it's going to be on Wednesday, right? So all the heavy-duty morning stuff in Sfarad would be start from that from the
Sunday.
Exactly.
But why? I don't understand.
Okay, because they're gonna everything revolves around the ninth of Av. You'll have a decrease of joy. Everybody agrees. The decrease of joy from the beginning of the month, but the actual week of where it occurs is where you have this extra. You know.
I think the Sephardim don't eat meat for that week.
From when? From Shua Shachalba. So you'll say that even this year, so that if it comes up on Shabbos, the whole week before, they're going to add on.
Like you're going to do Sunday, Monday, until Shabbat.
He's talking about Tisha B'Av Wednesday.
No. He's saying this year. If it comes out on Shabbos, he's saying the week before is the Shua Shachalba.
It takes 7 days.
Okay.
So it starts Sunday. You don't eat meat until Friday evening.
Okay.
Friday, you have to eat.
Right, for Shabbos, everything, all the laws kind of just go away.
I'm sorry, I'm confused.
Okay.
Because you use the word week, and when I hear week, I think of a week.
Right, so it's not. So we're saying the week that it's celebrated.
Could be 1 to 7 days.
Correct, okay. Correct, right, exactly, right. So that's like, so the week that it's celebrated.
So
okay.
This is the week in which it occurs.
Correct, right, so you see that there, so that's the next thing. When decreases in action during the week of which the ninth of Av occurs, that's the continuation of the Talmud. So that they're getting it's the Talmudic. So from the letter of the law of the Talmud, during the week in which the ninth of Av occurs, it is prohibited to cut one's hair, to launder clothes. But if the ninth of Av occurs on a Friday, on Thursday, then there's a special, you know, dispensation there to get ready for Shabbos. You would be able to wash clothes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
You see how it's going? Yes. Okay, fine. So this is so now according to Sephardic tradition. Like you see, how the Talmud states, comes along Rav Moshe Swillis and the Ashkenazic tradition. Come on, it's not enough. You know, it's like, I mean,
it's
I'm not
enough.
The no. So you'll say like this.
We do more.
We do more. We start. We have a thing called the 3 weeks. So not from the first of Av, but now we're going to start from the 17th of Tammuz, and all these things that we're going to say. Like, let's talk practically. So, not getting a haircut. Not shaving. They're always, you know, I'm going to say these are the laws, and then there's always like exceptions to every law. So just, you know, don't get bent out of shape. But the idea is.
No clothes shopping.
No, right. So again, you know, get probably no. Okay,
is there
let's
no
say.
Weddings during
that's the ones I'm about to say. So the big one is weddings, right? Weddings. So celebrations.
Someone had all these weddings this past week. Every time I drove by a shul this past week, it seemed like there was a wedding.
Right,
going
so that's so they're trying to get it in. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so they're trying to get it in. So right, so we see this idea. So now, so basically, what comes along is that you have the Rama who comes in and he says, We'll expand this from the 9 days or even less to the 3 weeks. Which in its what's interesting here is like this. This 3 week period, if you think about it from going back, everything's from the beginning when it starts. So like we said, the Jews come out of Egypt, Sinai, 40 days later, 17th of Tammuz, we mess up, and we have a breaking of the shattering of the tablets. When's the Tisha B'Av? Was there a Tisha B'Av this year, that year? No. It was the next year. Okay? Because now, because of the 17th of Tammuz thing, so now Moshe is busy going back and forth, up and down, getting us forgiveness. When do we get forgiven? Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, right? So that's where Yom Kippur becomes established as the Day of Atonement. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Didn't just happen. Becomes established as the Day of Atonement because that's when we found atonement, because God finally gives Moses the second set of tablets, it comes down, and we have that atonement. Now, next year, so what's that? That's Tishrei. So then comes Av the following year. So 40 days before that, the spies go into the land, come back with a negative report, and then everything falls apart.
That's what were they reporting on, by the way?
So they were looking, so that's the question. What was the purpose of their going in? Some say it was a practical thing. They were just looking from a military perspective. They wanted to see what's going on in the land, to know where they should go, where should they attack, et cetera, et cetera. That's one. And then others are saying they question whether or not this was a great land. So they already were doubting God's, you know, they were looking for trouble, so to speak, which is pretty much what goes down. There's a lot to be discussed on that. We're going to leave that.
So we didn't just get the, it wasn't like God said, this is your land. We had to go take the land.
Well, yeah, but it was going to be given to us in a sense. Okay, but so fine, that's Tisha B'Av. So, but what ends up happening is that we start to link these 2 days, the 17th of Tammuz, the breaking of the tablets, the golden calf, and the 9th of Av becomes like connected. It becomes like a continuum. In a certain sense, you see that here in the Talmud, that you have that's grouped together. The way the Talmud lays it out, it's saying, here's the 17th of Tammuz, 5 bad things happen here. Here's the 9th of Av, 5 bad things happen here. So you're starting to see like a kind of they're kind of being linked. So if I'm the Ramah, so you have 2 ways of looking at this Gemara. So you have like the straight reading, which would be, I guess, the Sephardic way of reading it, is that the Gemara says that things start occurring the week which the 9th of Av occurs. That's where we're going to start, you know, getting serious, right? Whereas if I'm looking at it from a bigger, if I take a step back and I look at the bigger picture, I said, wait a second, the Gemara is tying together these 2 days. This must be a bigger period than just 9 days or the week that the 9th of Av occurs. And so Moshe Isserles' school of thought is going to be, this is an expanded thing. So I'm not just going to look at it down as just the 9th of Av, when the month starts, of the Av starts and all that. I'm going to look at it as a bigger picture, 21 days. So you can look at the same Talmudic piece and you have both things can be said and interpreted and understood. Okay? So that's just the introduction.
Should I criticize?
You can, of course you can criticize.
3 quick thoughts.
Yes.
1, you can do whatever you want, but you could make, you know, apples and oranges very analogous. But this is pretty clear that it should start
on the week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my first
thought. Right, so that's right.
Yeah, but if the city walls were breached on that day,
right? So you see the Sephardic, like okay, they're called Sephardic school of thought here. It's a straighter, right? You're seeing a straighter, like you said, it reads more. That's like we call it the Ikar Adin. But when you look at the bigger picture, you see like there's something going on, that there's a connection between A and B. And their A and B now becomes an expanded, bigger picture of when you're looking at this period. It's a 3-week period.
There's a cost to this expansion, though. When the rabbis decide to make 3 weeks of pessimism and whatever,
No. So you know what's interesting is that's what it would be interesting to do a study. There are certain things, like for example, I Sfard, they would never. Say, like we have Yisker, right? So Yisker, you go to shul on a holiday, and then next thing you know, people are crying because they're remembering their lost, you know, their loved ones, right? Do you do that in Sfard? Never. So in Sfard, what are you doing? This is a holiday. Why are you crying? It's not something you do. So these are stereotypes of like the two, but there's different approaches as to like how we would look at these things.
Corn and Pesach.
Okay.
Corn and rice, right?
Right, but then, by Sfard. Okay, but then the flip side is by Sfard.
Come into your house.
Wait, but here's the little secret, right? How long do you do your slichos for?
About that long.
Okay, it's for a whole month, right? It's yeah, that's the painful. Guys have to get up for a full month at like whatever ungodly hour. We do it for not even. Okay, so it's like you know we joke like there's a trade off. But the idea though is there is So you see that there's a difference of school of thought approach that kind of trickles down. Okay, whatever it is.
It could be perspective. I mean, what one of the things that Rabbi Samson was talking about on Thursday was that the 3 weeks gives us some is another opportunity for us to have introspection as to what we're missing and how we can improve our lives and do what we can do.
Correct.
To bring the temple back, and that's that gives us an opportunity for growth as opposed to just mourning.
Right. So giving it, it's more opportunity. Exactly. Right. So again. These are the two sides. I mean, I'm here. It's educational. It's also important. What we do a lot of times is when we study halacha, we need to understand what is the law, because when it comes down to it, we live lives, complicated lives, and you need to know where is there flexibility, where there's no flexibility. To know that the letter of the law is this idea of the way the Talmud spells it out. So yes, we have this approach that we're expanding, 3 weeks, no music, live music, no weddings, this and that, other things of where we will implement, things in mourning, but there is going to be more flexibility earlier on, and as we get closer to the day, it becomes more serious, we become less flexible in terms of these things. Okay, that's just, I wasn't even planning going into depth, what I wanted to focus on today. Okay, now we can start the class, right?
Now you got the background.
Okay, now there's some background. Okay, so now we can talk. No, so what I wanted to focus on is that this is the 17th of Tammuz commemoration. So we see that the beginning, the first thing that happened was this breakdown of the calf, the golden calf, which is really very hard to understand. But I want to look at it inside the text of where we have a description of what happens. And then try to understand how we can apply it to ourselves today in terms of what's the takeaway for us. Like you said, right? Like just to get back to like understanding. Again, we've kind of put together some backdrop. And the fact that we come out and we have this incredible, incredible meeting and experience of meeting God in the most intimate way. I mean intimate, but like powerful way. And then for it to be able to then go to completely go off the rails, it's really hard to imagine how that could happen. So,
really,
yeah,
you think it's hard to imagine how we go off the rails
so quickly?
When have we stayed on the rails?
Well, so we did last night. We studied a piece from Maral where he was trying to understand like how did it happen? Like how do you explain it? And how come the Jews always seem to mess up? And his explanation was that the loftier one gets, the greater the... There's a balance in this world. So when you become loftier, the Yetzer Hara, the forces that are counter to that, will become that much more increased as well. So if we go loftier, guess what happens? We have a corresponding force in the negative that's there to go against us, okay? So that was how he explains that, how do you explain just on a basic level? Like, how do we go from being so lofty to falling so quickly and seem to always, and the way he describes it is if Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and Sarah, Rebecca, Leah, and Rachel are such lofty people, usually the way it works in this world, the nature of the world is that kids are usually like, not that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree type of thing. So then these are really like righteous people. So then it even begs the question more like, had their kids go, a couple of generations go down and then everything's fallen apart. It doesn't make sense if these are such high, lofty people. And the answer, though, is the way the Maral, this one approach, is that as you become loftier and become more connected, you also have a counterforce that's of equal strength that can potentially bring us down. And what we didn't cover yesterday was that also, as human beings, we lack. We always have. We're not perfect. And by definition, because we lack that, we have that imperfection, we're always susceptible to falling. So that those two forces, the counterforce and that lack that we all by nature have, we're human, so we're open to error. Okay, and that by the flip side is that as human beings, the positive is because we're open to error, we're also open to doing tshuva, to repenting, to being able to come back. And through that process, we grow and become greater and better. Okay.
Yeah,
fine. Exodus chapter 32. And this is the first actual, the first sentence here comes from the chapter before, because the chapters of the way the Bible set up is by the, it's not by the Jewish, it's by actually the chapters of our Bible are Christian in origin. And so if you look at a Chumash that has the proper, like that looks like a Torah, the breaks in the text are different. So you'll have chapters that don't correspond to the breaks in the text. So when a person wants to understand how God laid it out, you have to look at that, what the Torah looks like. We have Chumashim that shows that. So this first line is not in chapter 32. It's in chapter 31 because it's part of the... I don't know why they broke it up this way, but fine. So when he finished speaking with him on Mount Sinai, so God, when he finished speaking with Moses, he gave Moses the two tablets of the pact, the Luchos Habris, of the covenant, stone tablets inscribed with the finger of God. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, the people gathered against Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a God who shall go before us. For that man Moses, who brought us from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has happened to him." So first thing is like this. This is within the 39th or 40th day that Moses is up there. It's not clear. Did he tell them that he was coming down in 40 days? Did they have this idea that, not clear. But one of the things that if you go through the commentaries, they are like, you know, the Jewish people are waiting for Moses. They're not sure. But what's the problem that they have? If you think about it, here's this guy. He's up in the mountain with God. How the heck is he surviving? He has no food. He didn't eat, drink. He was sustained basically from something like the man. Like whatever manna was later on, that's probably what sustained him. He was able to get that sustenance that God gave us miraculously. Moses was getting that. But if they're sitting there going, what, you know, like he must have died already. I mean, you go up to Mount Everest and you're not down and like, you know, they have, you know where that guy is, right? So obviously not Mount Everest, but if a person's away that long up there, they're already starting to question whether he's coming back. So right away the reaction is we need to replace Moses. So they feel a need to replace Moses. The question really at the underlying this whole story is, when they started out, was it that they right away were jumping into idol worship? Or were they coming from a good place and then it went off the rails or something in between?
But if I remember well, it's not the Jewish, not the Israelites who brought that idea. It's the Erev Rav.
Okay, so what Jacob's referring to, so as you go through the story, so one of the things that the rabbis pick up on, yeah, not bad. One of the things that the rabbis pick up on is this idea that God keeps on saying to Moses, "Your people." So what do you mean, "your people"? So there is another way of looking at it that God says to Isaac, or God says to there's a funny back and forth in the Midrashim where God's talking to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob about the Jewish people sinning, and God says, "Your people." And Isaac says to him, "What do you mean, our people? It's your people too." Like that, like when a parent's upset at the kid and they scream, they go, "Your kid." And like, what do you mean, your kid? It's our, right? So it could be you learn it that way. Or like what Jacob's saying is that Moses pulled a group of people, which we end up called the Erev Rav, like this mixture, multitude of groups of people that he took with them out of Egypt with the Jewish people, who ended up becoming a problem that they brought foreign ideas.
God didn't want to bring him.
Correct. It was so Moses,
Moshe
right?
Argue with him,
right, and Moses.
That's why.
Right. So that's
when Moshe came up.
Right. So that perhaps that's up. So you see what when you this.
Well, also this being what is it? What's Jewish it? People,
I said I'm learning so much today that okay. I don't even know if I can like.
Okay. Well, pay all you think about it. It's okay.
Yeah. But also the people leaving. I mean, the truth of the matter is the people leaving Egypt, even the Jews leaving Egypt at that point didn't have the, I mean, there was no law.
What's interesting is that when you go through, and this is, we could do a class on just trying to, looking at text and trying to understand the text, but you can look in the words and you see what the rabbis say, this Erev Rav type of idea, it's a foreign group. It could be that, no, it's the Jewish people. That the Jewish people somehow get pulled in, or both. There are different streams of thought There's a whole, I have a book, it's called the Torah Shlema. It's a beautiful book. It's like, it pulls all the different midrashim, and in there he has a summary of all the different positions of what happened in this story. It's a lot of different approaches. So we're going to try to keep it, I want to just keep it, like, well, let's go through, we'll pull our own understanding already. You have
Jonathan's point of view for right now.
It's not my point of view. It's actually, I'm looking for you to help me. We're going to try to figure this out, okay? Because we need
what
to take
it. What is this that we're trying to figure out?
What exactly went broke down with the at the sin of the golden calf, okay? And then also, why did Moses break? Why was Moses' reaction so severe? Because that's another thing that's happening here. Meaning, a lot of times we mess up. It doesn't mean that we're going to destroy our connection with God. That's the other thing that we could talk about. What are the tablets? What do the tablets represent? Here's a question. Moses, the Jewish people, they experience the revelation, okay? Great. So what do we need the tablets for? Mm-hmm. What do you need tablets for?
Well, they said it was too much, and they told, they said...
Moses conveyed to them. Right. So God says, Moses, you tell them the last eight. Great, so they heard, tell them, the first two God gave us directly. The Jewish people said, we cannot handle this, this is over too much. So God then gave it to Moses, who Moses conveyed to them, all happening at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai. And then 40 days later, there's this gap, something's going on there. Moses and God, tablets haven't come down yet. They're only coming down the 40 days after. So the question asked is, what do you need the tablets for?
Well, they represent the rest of the laws. I mean, only the first 10 are just, I think, symbolic of the entirety of the.
Okay, so you Torah. So you're saying so that basically
613 were on there.
So you're saying so those first set of tablets had more than just 10 commandments, saying it's good. Yeah. Right? So in that first, there were the way we'll see here.
Were there?
What?
More than 10?
No, there were 10 commandments, but the whole Torah, somehow, which today is not so hard to believe because I have in here the whole Torah. No, seriously.
And the Mishnah and the Gemara.
I got it all in here. So the idea that they can have an entire scope of knowledge on this area is. We can get it now because we have things like this small that have crazy amounts of information on it, right? So you're saying so that for 40 days, Moses and God are going through not just the Ten Commandments, but an additional, okay? That's one. And that sounds like the way we describe it, that these tablets had a lot on them. It just wasn't the Ten Commandments that we see.
It says there were six wide and back both sides.
Good. Okay, so that's one approach.
Or on the other hand, they were trying to narrow it down to just 10 that he felt that everyone could follow that would encompass everything you need. Like the Ten Commandments are like the basis.
Right.
So you have the 613 mitzvot, which is more in depth.
Right.
But maybe he felt, look, I want to get the people to believe that you gave us this and to embrace it, and so that they would have something more simple to follow.
Okay. So you want to think it's this, but here it's like it's this, and this. Okay.
But maybe it took them all that time to come down to like just the simple ideas of. What's the 10 most important things?
So the chapter titles are only.
Interesting. Exactly.
Or maybe he knew that Moses was going to be gone a long time, so he gave him the first 10, say, here. Digest this.
But what is definitely coming down, when Moses is coming down, you ever see the history of the world?
Mm-hmm.
First there were the 15,
and
he's chiseling. Okay, what's that? He's definitely bringing him down the Ten Commandments. What Mark is saying is that there's something, you know.
They're encoded.
There's something much bigger here, to the point where all of Torah of all time was there. Mm-hmm. You know, how we can't, again, at least we have something that we can at least get our heads around, that there's something way of having a mass of information in a small thing. Okay, but nevertheless, there's still the Ten Commandments, and that, so the question again is, what do you need them for? Especially if God already, and Moses gave over to them, here, verbally, I'm telling you everything. So what do you have to bring it down? So yesterday I asked this question. There was a lawyer behind me. He says, well, you got to make a document, you know? You have to memorialize it. You have to have it in writing, right?
It has to be clear and you don't want to forget.
Right? So there is something to be said for that. So I'm actually, like, Rabbi Neuberger's Mechun, he wrote, he just came out with a Sefer, Mati's father-in-law. It's unbelievable. It's this beautiful book that I got it this week and I started going through it. He's talking about this, just this idea of the tablets and why we needed them to moralize, to the way it's described here. If you turn the back here, just look at this for a second. The Talmud Yerushalmi and Tanis. So there's no English translation to this. I wrote my own very bad little English thing here, just to give you something. So, but Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman Mishem Rabbi Yonasan, he says that Haluchas Hayorcha and Shisha Tvachim Berachban Shlosha. So that the what was the size of them? They were 6 in length, 3 wide. There's another one that says they were 6 wide, different versions. But the way this is the takeaway is that V'haya Moshe Tafis B'tfachayim. Moses is holding the 2 lower cubits. God's got the 2 above, and there's a space of 2 between. So that's an image that you have to see, because Moses is representing the Jewish people. Here's God, and they're with the Torah, and the Torah is what's being held from both sides. This is where we become connected to God. This is where that which is above and that which is below, the spiritual realms and the physical realms comes together and meet and become connected.
So they're floating in the air, basically.
Well, it's just, but this idea of coming together, right? But that this is like
it's the bridge. Physical connection.
Right? It's the physical bridge. Mm-hmm. Right, so you have this physical bridge between the two. That image is very important, right? So we need to see what the tablets become is the symbolic connection between us and God. Okay, and that everything that's on them, so how are they broken up? Just again, another side thing here is that they're broken up 5 and 5. The first 5 are between us and God, and then the latter 5 are between us and our fellow man, okay? So if you look at the verbiage, if you look at the wording of the two sides, there's a lot more words on the right side than on the left, right? It says, don't kill, don't steal. On the other one, it's like, I am Hashem, your God, I took you out of the land of Egypt. You know, there's a lot of, when it comes to the laws of Sabbath, it's like, there's a whole paragraph there, right? Here on this side, there's maybe 20 words total. So how do you balance it out? So as a graphic designer, right? The words on this side of number 2, they're much bigger, right? It's don't kill. It's font 25. This one's font 6, you know? It's make it balanced, okay? But when you look at that, what does it tell you? It's hello, this is really important. Or it's emphasis on, just on an image. You should do that. You should actually make it so people could see. That's a very cool, you should, okay? If you don't mind a little homework, I know you're busy, but that's actually, you could do it probably in 5 minutes, and it's really cool to see that. So he was saying, but understand that the idea of love thy neighbor, let's say, or things that are interpersonal on this side are connected with I am Hashem, your God. The idea that we have to be good to others is predicated on the fact that there's a God. It's this is a package deal. That answers the question also, is that when Moses comes down, and you have these 2 sets of tablets that I think it sounds like they were actually carrying 2 separate tablets. And if they're basically messing up on tablet 1, why does he break tablet 2? What he's teaching us is that they go together. They're intertwined. And that's why he ends up breaking both, even though they only messed up on side 1. Side 2 goes down with it together because it's a package. But okay. But just to go back. The tablets then, if they have to come down 40 days later, we have this massive information, there's more going on, there's a lot of work being done, but you need the tablets to memorialize, but also it's this image of the connection that we're going to have with God. That, where did these tablets go, by the way, in the end? Do you know where they sit? The broken tablets?
It's in the ark.
Correct.
In the ark.
Where does the ark sit?
In the
Mishkan. Exactly, right? So at the core of our, it's the place of what? Of interconnection. The Beit HaMikdash, right. the temple is where we connect with God on the highest plane. That's what we're missing, right? Mm-hmm. We don't even realize, right? Mm-hmm. Rabbi Samson in his Thursday class said, we don't even realize. What are we mourning? Because we don't even realize what we're missing. It's that bad. But the idea of this, of what we're talking about here, and now we start to get a sense of, like, you want to know what this is all about. This is all about our connection with God. The 17th of Tammuz is when Moses is bringing down the tablets which represent and memorialize our connection with God, which is this image of the Talmud Yerushalmi of God here, us, Moses here, which is us, and the two that are in between is the connection between us and God. So that's what these tablets are. So now, when the story goes on and Moses comes down and he sees what's going on and he breaks them, it's like, the question I want to understand is, why does he break them? Why does Moses feel that he should break them?
He was, Kinyan Hashem Hashem. He was very upset.
So
was
he okay. So he
was he embarrassed?
He was angry. It says that he was angry. Well, we'll see. Let's read. I'm going to skip.
Well, you can be both.
Okay. But the question is still the here. Still here's. Here's.
Why was he so surprised? Didn't God tell him
to grow up? Oh, here he is. Yeah. Great question. So let's ask that. So what's so?
He said that down there they made a calf. They're sitting there doing all this stuff.
So why didn't he break them down? Right? Would that be the question?
Well, I want to know why he was so surprised.
No, he's not surprised.
He got
No. You're saying surprised. He's not surprised. He's not surprised.
Well, he was. What's God, the difference God between when he was already, up on top and when he actually...
Okay, so let's see. I'm going to...
Angrier. Sometimes you're like...
God warning.
You're stewing in your head.
Look at it. Look. So let's see. You see where it says the... Look at the line. Here, let's read. Okay. Let's read. Here, let's read. The Lord... I'm jumping now. They already made the calf, okay? Just that. Just go back a two, three lines. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron announced, "Tomorrow shall be the festival of the Lord," which is interesting, because there we see that Aaron's hoping that things will turn quickly, that Moses will get back in time, and that tomorrow will actually be a celebration to God, not to this, you know, golden calf. But okay. Early the next day, the people offered up burnt offerings and brought sacrifice of all being. They sat down to eat and drink, and then rose to dance. Okay, so this is already, things are starting to break out. They're starting to dance. Okay, the Lord spoke to Moses, "Hurry down, your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have acted basely. They have been quick to turn aside from the way that I enjoined upon them. They have made themselves a molten calf and bowed low to it and sacrificed it, saying, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt.'" So now they've transferred. So that's one of the things that they're saying, that they're using this as a medium. Sometimes... And that could be the beginning of idol worship or foreign worship is not necessarily that anybody in their right mind thinks that some kind of idol has powers, but that they're using it as a medium. We need to have symbols. And so that's, God says, no symbols, guys, because it leads to bad things. Okay, but you see that could be the derivation of where things went wrong, was they started looking for symbols, and they were actually trying to get to God through the symbol. Not allowed to do that. There's nothing between us and God. That's it's hard, and that's something that we struggle with. And this is the idea of where we project a lot of times a God figure that, you know, where we take our personal and we kind of project it onto like what God should be. That's something that we all need to work on, which is probably, that's also one of the takeaways I wanted to talk about. But fine, let's get down. Let's go here. The Lord further said to Moses, "I see that this is a stiff-necked people. Now let me be, that my anger may blaze forth against them, and that I may destroy them, and make of you a great nation." So God's saying basically, let's be done with these people, and let's start over. You, me, Moses, let's start a new thing. But Moses implored the Lord, his God, saying, "Let not your anger, O Lord, blaze forth against your people, whom you delivered from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand." Almost like saying God. God is saying that... I'm saying Moses is saying to God, like, this whole enterprise, you know, for you to throw out the Jewish people would make it look bad on you, reflect poorly on you. That's kind of what Moses' defense, right, as defense attorney here, right? He's kind of turning it around. Let not the Egyptians say it was the evil intent that he delivered them only to kill them off in the mountains and annihilate them from the face of the earth. Turn from your blazing anger and renounce the plan to punish your people. Now, what's interesting is, God getting so angry. We see this in general, that when the Jewish people are worshiping idols, that again, does God have any emotion? No. Where it's an anthropomorphic description, but this is something that our actions will generate or activate this type of reaction from God, and that we will understand it as anger, that this, like, you know, like jealous anger, sometimes you see jealousy or anger, but this idea, this like strong reaction that God has to when we are worship idols, when we go away from God. So remember your servants, Abram, Isaac, and Israel, how you swore to them by yourself and said to them, I will make your offspring as numerous as the stars of heaven, and I will give to your offering this whole land which I spoke to possess forever. And the Lord renounced the punishment he had planned to bring upon his people. So right there, Moses' quick discussion, God says, you're right. It's back to the, it's again, it's all predicated, we're built on our forefathers. It's all built on that. And therefore God says, okay, I forgive, I'm willing to let this go, where I'm not going to destroy them. Now again, the question becomes, so now God told him that they did this, but he doesn't break the tablets there. So I asked a friend of mine, I have a Hasidic friend, he's a very bright guy. I said, Maury, what do you think the answer to this is? He says, because he never could believe anything bad about another Jew. That's what he said. He said, God, even God. I don't believe it. I cannot accept that you're going to say something bad about another Jew. I don't believe it. Okay, I see it. That's a different story. But I can't take your word for it. That was his answer. But here, maybe there's something else that's going on in the text. I told him a little different answer. Let's see what it says. So thereupon Moses turned and went down from the mountain, bearing the two tablets of the pact, tablets inscribed on both their surfaces. They were inscribed on one side and on the other. So he's starting to see this like description of the tablets were God's work, and the writing was God's writing incised upon the tablets. So it's kind of indicating to us that these are special things, right? Again, really like accentuating the loss, because now we're going to lose out something very special that's otherworldly, that when this happens, when they're broken, it's something that's lost forever. The flip side is that, yeah, we lost it, but maybe that's by design, that we need to like work our way through this. We can't just get the handout from God. That's kind of like what the answer really is that we by the system is set up that we're going to have to evolve and work and evolve and continue to work to get back to this place, and to get the handout of this, what's being described here, is something that would not necessarily be good for us. And when Joshua heard the sound of the people in its boisterousness, he said to Moses, there is a cry of war in the camp. But he answered, it is not the sound of the tune of triumph or the sound of the tune of defeat. It is the sound of the song that I hear. As soon as Moses came near the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, he became enraged, and he hurled the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of the mountain. Okay, so now, what's different here? Because God told Moses that the people had made a golden calf, right? They made an idol. So what did he say? He said, "Hurry down, your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have acted basely. They have been quick to turn aside from the way that I enjoined upon them. They have made themselves a molten calf and bowed low to it and sacrificed it to a thing, etc." What's different here?
He sees it.
Okay, A, that's one.
Well, God was angry at first, and Moses was advocating for God not to be so angry.
Okay, and then Moses kind of takes over God's position.
Now he becomes enraged.
But what did he see that was different than what he heard from God? So you're saying
the difference is dancing is what they see.
Boom, okay, the mechalot. They were dancing. Okay, so now if it's like when you have it, let's use our kids as an example. So our kids mess up. So we react differently to different things that they do. When, you know, and appropriately so. Like when we, like, let's say, I try to think of different cases of where they did something stupid. It's like, if they do things that are just, they made a bad mistake, okay. But if they do something that's so stupid that it's like beyond any type of repair, so then your reaction or what you have to do is to be that much more extreme.
If it's to some other person versus something.
Well, again, to your but whatever the thing is. So like I don't know. I'll give an example. So my son, you know, I'm not going to say which son, okay? Okay. So he'll do something stupid with driving. Okay. So like, you know, you can't drive for the next week. So, but then he like does something that's so outrageous. Like it was just like it's like so stupid. It's like you're not driving. I'm taking your license away. You're not driving next year, okay? I'm ripping up your license. Like I mean, so if I see something that's so bad that it's like it can't even, it's not even fixable for the time being, I have to like rip up the license, okay? So God tells Moses, listen, the Jewish people, they just started worshiping idols. Moses says, God, listen, it's not so bad. Give them a break, give them some space, okay? But when he comes down and he sees the thing, okay, seeing is believing, great, but he sees something extra. He sees that they're dancing around. What he sees is that not only have they decided to do something stupid, but they're celebrating that. That means that they've entrenched themselves. When you make a circle, what you're saying is, I'm entrenching within that act. Moses says, that's already. So it's not that he didn't believe. He believed what God told him. But when he saw that they'd entrenched themselves in this thing that was so outrageously off, and understood that now, if I am going to give them this special thing, the tablets, which represents this close connection between God and the Jewish people, and I'm going to hand it to them, that's going to be the worst thing ever. At the end of the Torah, the five books of Moses, at the last line, there are two things that are said that apply to this. One is, God makes reference, there's another Talmudic piece that talks about, at this moment, which we described, when this thing happened, it actually describes a struggle. That God said, okay, wait a second, they're sitting with the gold calf, wanting to pull it away. Moses, on the other hand, said, no, we need it. And he starts pulling. And it says that Moses actually ends up getting stronger than God and pulls the tablets down. He says, no, you're not taking it away. To say, the tablets will remain with us. Wait a bit, to the point where these tablets are broken and shattered, they're gathered up, and they're put into the ark that sits in the Beis HaMikdash. So the connection is always going to be there, needs to be shattered, but the connect is there. Moses prevails over God in that case. But nevertheless, he says, this has to be broken, and we have to start over, because they got so entrenched to give them, and give these tablets in whole to them the way they were, is toxic. They're celebrating it. It's not like they're just, okay, we messed up. Oh, God, we feel bad. No, we're dancing. They got out the band. They're like, you know, let's go. We just sin. Let's go. You know, it's like, that's outrageous. So Moses says, this cannot be. He breaks it. So this is going to be, the shattering of these tablets will always be the breaking of walls, right? That's why the breach of the wall is on the 17th of Tammuz. You'll see the breaking of the Tamid, the constancy. It's broken. Again, the same concept, the same theme is coming through again and again. Okay, so what happens is here, so the takeaway, first of all, the positive is that there are these tablets. There is this idea of a connection with God that's eternal, right? But it's broken and has to be rebuilt, which is Yom Kippur, right? Like, again, we're going to make the second set. We're going to now become partners with God, okay? But we have to understand, the takeaway also is that we have the ability, unfortunately, to mess up in such a major way, but also what we end up all doing is we not only mess up, but then we start justifying the mess up. Not only that, then we bring out, let's make a party because we messed up, because it's actually okay. So that's where, like, it's human nature, but it's where that, when we go down that path, it becomes toxic. And as a people, we did it, that we come back to this and we say, you know, wow, look what we missed out on. And it's something that repeats itself. Five times, it's just showing that this is a repetitive type of thing, that breaches occur, that breakdowns occur. And so the first thing we have to do is, like what Rabbi Samson's saying, is that we have to be a cognizant of the fact that we don't even realize. Mm-hmm. Here is we're saying, like, we have to realize that we have this proclivity to, you know, fall into this trap and to take things that are wrong and then to make them, celebrate them, make them, so to speak, right. And so the work that to get back to the right place is to, I guess, try to, you know, bridge that gap to get back to God and to try to figure out ways to bring things back together. So I, you know, when we have a fast day in general, whether it be the 17th of Tammuz, the 9th of Av, and we're sad, but also it's really a time for repentance. It's the time to reflect. And the simple takeaway is to take something and to improve ourselves. As Jews, we're the people of the book, is the idea of increasing knowledge, to spend a little more time, to take this which we have by our sides and constantly looking at, and to put it aside or to use it only for study or to learn something more, to grow, to look for ways and opportunities to make ourselves better and to become more connected to our friends, our family, and to the Jewish people. So like that's a takeaway for we don't just fast to make ourselves miserable, but we fast and we use it as a time to be reflective and to say, what more can I do? It's just that it's funny. I just moved the Lubavitcher Rebbe's Telishkin's book on the Rebbe. So the major takeaway that Lana and I have from that book is that the Rebbe always used to say, people came in, I've done such and such. He was so proud, and the Rebbe said, what more can you do? And like that was his mantra. But that's for us, like the takeaway for us is, what more can we do? We have to look for rooms for paths in our lives to be able to grow more, to add more time and opportunity to study, to pray, to do all these things to make ourselves to grow. Because as human beings, as opposed to angels who are standing, who are not moving, we're moving people. God says to Abraham, Lech Lecha, I want you to move. Our directive is to be moving people, to be in a state of growth. And so the 17th of Tammuz, things were broken. How do we pick up the pieces? By making ourselves look at opportunities to grow and to go further and further ahead in growth and growth opportunities. And God willing, that we should take that. Yeah?
But just, Moses just wrote the tablets the way they are, but Yad Hashem, God made those. He imprinted everything. That's why they were very, very holy.
Right.
And that's why if God made that, that's kind of a connection for us. Because that's God made that.
Right. So that's the good thing about it is that they did. We never threw. We didn't take those tablets and throw them in the garbage. No, they became. The, they exactly. became right. They, and they. So that's still how we have.
That's why they're holy. That's why you kept them in the Beit HaMikdash.
Correct. And we still have that. Correct. We still have that connection. Things. Right. And we still have that connection. The connection's there, but what our job is to be able to make and to continue to evolve and to grow and to put those back together.
And by the way, for us, for the Sephardic, from Yud Zayin B'Tammuz, we don't go to the beach, we don't do parties, just, it's because this is the worst time for what we believe, and that happens from back then and even until today. A lot of
bad things happen
to the Jewish people in general. If you look at the history, from the Zayin Tammuz until Tisha B'Av, it's the worst thing happens to us as a nation, not individual people.
Right, so it's a time.
There's a lot of things in the history that very bad things happen in that period of time.
Correct.
So people try to eliminate risk. If you in Israel, there is a lot of death in between the Zayin Tammuz to Tisha B'Av in people drowning. Pools, beaches.
Right.
We believe in those things, so we don't go. A lot of people don't do that. Those things.
It's a time to be try to stay from doing dangerous things. And I'm back to the flip side. Is that again also on the positive side? No, but it's important to be aware that it's a time that things are not necessarily in our favor in the upper world, let's say. But also again, I think on a constructive, positive thing that whenever there's that darkness. A little light makes a big impact. So that, therefore, that's what we should use it as a time of good to bring more light.